Geographic Society, a floor mosaic of a compass denoting the society's interest in the four corners of the earth and their intermediate points, east, northeast, north, northwest, west, southwest, south, southeast. It was this, we believe, that the design's ancient painters, too, had in mind, to indicate there and the place's association with the four regions of the earth. That the rayed star had no sacred significance is further attested by the disrespect with which it was surrounded by graffiti. These, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 60, depict thick-walled buildings, fins of fishes, birds, wings, a ship, and even some suggest a sea dragon, upper left-hand corner. And these graffiti, yellow and brown of various shades, appear in addition to the colors already mentioned. Of particular interest are two shapes in which large twin eyes are prominent. We have a better knowledge of what they depicted, for such shapes were found painted on a much larger scale and with greater detail on the walls of other houses. The objects were depicted as spherical or oval in shape, their upper part layered and painted in black and white. The center was dominated by the two large eyes, perfect black discs within white circles. The bottom part showed in red two, or four, extended supports. Between these mechanical legs there protruded from the object's main body a bulbous contraption, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 61. What were these objects? Were they the whirlwinds of the Near Eastern texts, including the Old Testament? The flying saucers of the Anunnaki? The murals, the circular pits, the bands of ashes, the strewn blackened pebbles, the location of the place? All that was uncovered, and probably much that was not, bespeak Tel Gasul as a stronghold and supply depot for the patrol aircraft of the Anunnaki. The Tel Gasul-Jericho crossing point played important and miraculous roles in several biblical events, a fact that may have enhanced the Vatican's interest in the site. It was there that the prophet Elijah crossed the river to its eastern bank in order to keep an appointment at Tel Gasul, to be taken aloft by a chariot of fire in a whirlwind. It was in that area that at the end of the Israelite exodus from Egypt, Moses, having been denied by the Lord entry into Canaan proper, went up from the plain of Moab, the area of Tel Gasul, unto the Mount of Nebo, to its uppermost peak, which overlooked Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land, the Gilead up to Dan, and the land of Naphtali, and the land of Ephraim, and Manasseh, and the whole land of Judea, unto the Mediterranean, and the Negev, and the plain valley of Jericho, the city of date palms. It is a description of a view as encompassing as that seen by the archaeologists who stood atop Tel Gasul. The crossing itself, under the leadership of Joshua, entailed the miraculous backing up of the Jordan's waters, under the influence of the Holy Ark and its contents. It was then, when Joshua was by Jericho, that he raised his eyes, and lo and behold, there stood a man opposite him, and his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went unto him, and said unto him, Art thou with us, or with our enemies? And he said, Neither. A captain of the host of the Lord am I. And Joshua fell on his face to the ground, and bowed, and said unto him, What saith my Lord unto his servant? And the captain of the host of Yahweh said unto Joshua, Remove thy shoe off thy foot, for the place where thou standest is restricted. Then the captain of the troops of Yahweh divulged to him the Lord's plan for the conquest of Jericho. Do not attempt to storm its walls by force, he said. Instead, carry the Ark of the Covenant around its walls 7 times. And on the 7th day, the priests sounded the trumpets, and the people let out a great cry, as they were commanded, and the walls of Jericho came tumbling down. Jacob, too, crossing the Jordan at night on his return to Canaan from Haran, ran into a man, and the two wrestled till dawn. Only then did Jacob realize that his opponent was a deity, and Jacob called the place Peniel, the face of God, for I had seen a God face to face and have survived. Indeed, the Old Testament clearly states that there had been in earlier times settlements of the Anunnaki at the vital approaches to the Sinai Peninsula and Jerusalem. Hebron, the city guarding the route between Jerusalem and the Sinai, was called earlier Kiryat Arba, stronghold of Arba. A great man, king, among the Anakim, he was. The descendants of the Anakim, we are further told, were still residing in the area during the Israelite conquest of Canaan. And there are numerous other biblical references to abodes of the Anakim on the east side of the Jordan. Who were these Anakim? The term is commonly translated giants, just as the biblical term Nephilim has been translated. But we have already shown conclusively that by Nephilim, those who had come down, the Old Testament had referred to the people of the rocket ships. The Anakim, we suggest, were none other than the Anunnaki. No one had hitherto paid any particular attention to the count of 3,650 years, which Manetho assigned to the reign of the demigods who belonged to the dynasty of Thoth. We, however, find the figure highly significant, for it differs but by 50 years from the 3,600-year orbit of Nibiru, the home planet of the Anunnaki. It was no accident, we have maintained, that mankind's advancement from the Stone Age to the high civilization of Sumer occurred in 3,600-year intervals, circa 11,000, 7,400, and 3,800 B.C. It was as though a mysterious hand had each time picked man out of his decline and raised him to an even higher level of culture, knowledge, and civilization. We wrote in the 12th planet, each instance, we hold, coincided with the recurrence of the time when the Anunnaki could come and go between Earth and Nibiru. These advances spread from the Mesopotamian nucleus throughout the ancient world, and the Egyptian Age of the Demigods, offspring of the cohabitation of gods and humans, from circa 7100 BC to 3450 BC per Manetho, unquestionably coincides with the Neolithic period in Egypt. We can assume that at each of these intervals, the fate of mankind and the gods' relations with it were discussed by the great Anunnaki, the seven who decree. We know for sure that such a deliberation had taken place prior to the sudden and otherwise inexplicable blooming of the Sumerian civilization, for the Sumerians have left us records of such discussions. When the reconstruction of Sumer began, first to have been rebuilt on its soil, were the olden cities, but no longer as exclusive cities of the gods. For mankind was now allowed into these urban centers to tend the surrounding fields, orchards, and cattle folds in behalf of the gods, and to be in the service of the gods in all conceivable manners, not only as cooks and bakers, artisans and clothiers, but also as priests, musicians, entertainers, and temple prostitutes. First to be re-established was Eridu. Having been Enki's first settlement on earth, it was given to him anew in perpetuity. His initial shrine there, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 62, a marvel of architecture in those early days, was in time raised and expanded to a magnificent temple abode, the Enguera, house of the Lord whose return is triumphant, adorned with gold, silver, and precious metals from the lower world, and protected by the Bull of Heaven. For Enlil and Ninlil, Nippur was re-established. There they raised a new Iker, mountain house, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 63. This time equipped not as Mission Control Center, but with awesome weapons. The lifted eye which scans the land, and the lifted beam which penetrates all. Their sacred area also housed Enlil's fast-stepping bird, whose grasp no one could escape. A hymn to Eridu, edited and translated by A. Falkenstein, describes how Enki traveled to attend a gathering of all the great gods. The occasion was a visit by Anu to Earth. For one of those deliberations that determined the fate of gods and men on Earth every 3,600 years. After some celebrating, when the gods, the intoxicating beverage, had drunk, the wine prepared by men, it was time for solemn decisions. Anu sat on the seat of honor. Near him sat Enlil. Ninhursag sat on an armchair. Anu called the meeting to order, and to the Anunnaki thus said, "Great gods who had hither come, Anuna gods, who to the court of assembly had come. My son had for himself a house built, the Lord Enki, Eridu like the mountain on earth he raised. His house and a beautiful place he built. To the place Eridu, no one uninvited can enter. In its sanctuary, from the Abzu, the divine formulas Enki had deposited." This brought the deliberations to the main item on the agenda. Enlil's complaint that Enki was withholding from the other gods the divine formulas. The knowledge of more than 100 aspects of civilization, confining advancement to Eridu and its people only. It is an archaeologically confirmed fact that Eridu was Sumer's oldest post-diluvian city, the fountainhead of Sumerian civilization. It was then decided that Enki must share the divine formulas with the other gods, so that they too could establish and re-establish their urban centers. Civilization was to be granted to the whole of Sumer. When the official part of the deliberations was over, the gods who were on Earth had a surprise from the celestial visitors. Midway between Nippur and Eridu, they had built a sacred precinct in honor of Anu, an abode appropriately named Iana, House of Anu. Before they left Earth, back for the home planet, Anu and Antu, his spouse, paid an overnight visit to their earthly temple. It was an occasion marked by pomp and circumstance. As the divine couple reached the new town, later to be known as Uruk, the biblical Erek, the gods accompanied them in a procession to the temple's courtyard. While a sumptuous evening meal was prepared, Anu, seated on a throne, chatted with the male gods. Antu, accompanied by the female goddesses, changed her clothes in the temple section called House of the Golden Bed. Priests and other temple attendants served wine and good oil, and slaughtered in sacrifice a bull and a ram for Anu, Antu, and all the gods. But the banquet was delayed until it was dark enough to see the planets. Jupiter, Venus, Mercury, Saturn, Mars, and the Moon, as soon as they shall appear. With this, and after a ceremonial washing of the hands, the first part of the meal was served. Bull meat, ram meat, fowl, as well as prime beer and pressed wine. A pause was then made for the highlight of the evening. While one group of priests began to chant the hymn, Kaka Banyu Etalu Shamame, the planet of Anu rises in the skies. A priest went up to the topmost stage of the tower of the temple to watch the skies for the appearance of the planet of Anu, Nibiru. At the expected moment, and in the predetermined spot in the heavens, the planet was sighted. Thereupon the priests broke out in singing the compositions, "To the one who grows bright, the heavenly planet of the Lord Anu, and the Creator's image has arisen." A bonfire was lit in signal, and as the news spread from one observation post to another, bonfires were lit in one place after another. Before the night was over, the whole land was alight. In the morning, prayers of thanksgiving were offered in the temple's chapel, and in a sequence filled with ceremony and symbolism, the celestial visitors began their departure. "Anu is leaving," the priests chanted. "Anu, great king of heaven and earth, we ask for your blessing," they intoned. After Anu gave the asked-for blessings, the procession wound its way down the street of the gods to the place of the bark of Anu. There were more prayers and hymn singing at a chapel called Build Life on Earth. Now it was time for those remaining behind to bless the departing couple, and the following verses were recited. Great on you. May heaven and earth bless you. May the gods Enlil, Ea, and Ninma bless you. May the gods Sin and Shamash bless you. May the gods Nergal and Ninurta bless you. May the Agigi, who are in heaven, and the Anunnaki, who are on earth, bless you. May the gods of the Abzu, and the gods of the Holy Land, bless you. And then on you and on to took off to the spaceport. It was the 17th day of their visit to Earth. A tablet found in the archives of Uruk states, the momentous visit was over. Its decisions opened the way for the establishment of new cities, besides the olden ones. First and foremost among them was Kish. It was put under the control of Ninurta, Enlil's foremost son. He turned it into Sumer's first administrative capital. For Nannar, Sin, Enlil's firstborn, the new urban center of Ur, the city was established, a place that was to become Sumer's economic heart. There were additional decisions concerning the new era in mankind's advancement and its relations with the Anunnaki. We read in the Sumerian texts concerning the crucial conclave that launched Sumer's great civilization, that the great Anunnaki who decree the fate decided that the gods were too lofty for mankind. The term used, Elu, in Akkadian, means exactly that, lofty ones. From it comes the Babylonian, Assyrian, Hebrew, and Ugaritic El, the term to which the Greeks gave the connotation God. There was a need, the Anunnaki decided, to give mankind kingship as an intermediary between themselves and the human citizenry. All the Sumerian records attest that this major decision was taken during Anu's visit at a council of the great gods. One Akkadian text describes thus the meeting that had taken place in long-ago days, in far-off times. The gods of the land, Anu, Enlil, and Inki, convened an assembly. Enlil and the gods took counsel. Among them was seated Shamash. Among them was seated Ninma. At that time there was not yet kingship in the land. The rule was held by the gods. But the great council resolved to change that and to grant kingship to mankind. All the Sumerian sources agree that the first royal city was Kish. The men who were appointed by Enlil to be kings were called Lugal, mighty man. We find the same record in the Old Testament. When mankind was establishing its kingdoms, Kish begot Nimrod. He was the first to be a mighty man in the land. And the beginning of his kingship, Babel and Erech and Akkad, all in the land of Shinar, Sumer. While the biblical text names the first three capitals as Kish, Babylon, and Erech, the Sumerian king lists assert that kingship moved from Kish to Erech and then to Ur, omitting any mention of Babylon. The apparent discrepancy has a reason. We believe it has to do with the incident of the Tower of Babel, Babylon, which the Old Testament records in no small detail. It was an incident, we believe, that had to do with Marduk's insistence that he, rather than Nannar, should possess Sumer's next capital. The time was clearly during the resettlement of the plain of Sumer, the biblical Shinar, when new urban centers were being built. And as they traveled from the east, they found a valley in the land of Shinar, and settled there. And they said unto one another, let us make bricks, and burn them by fire. And the bricks served them as stone, and the bitumen served them as mortar. It was then that the scheme which caused the incident was suggested by an unnamed instigator. Come, let us build us a city, and a tower whose head shall reach the heavens. And Yahweh came down to see the city and the tower which the humans were building. And he said to unnamed colleagues, this is just the beginning of their undertakings. From now on, anything that shall scheme to do shall no longer be impossible for them. And Yahweh said to his colleagues, come, let us go down and confuse their language, so that they would not understand each other's speech. Then the Lord scattered them from there all over the face of the earth, and they ceased to build the city. That there was initially a time when mankind spoke in unison is a tenet of Sumerian historical recollections. These also assert that the confusion of languages accompanying the dispersion of mankind was a deliberate act of the gods. Like the Old Testament, the writings of Berossus reported that the gods introduced a diversity of tongues among men, who until that time had all spoken the same language. Like the biblical tale, the histories of Berossus connect the diversification of languages and the dispersion of mankind to the incident of the Tower of Babel, when all men formerly spoke the same language. Some among them undertook to erect a large and lofty tower, that they might climb up to heaven. But the Lord, sending forth a whirlwind, confounded their design, and gave to each tribe a particular language of its own. The conformity of the tales suggests the existence of a common older source, from which both the compilers of the Old Testament and Berossus had obtained their information. Although it is generally assumed that such an original text has not yet been found, the fact is that George Smith, in his very first publication in 1876, reported discovering at Ashurbanipal's library in Nineveh a mutilated account of part of the story of the tower. The tale, he concluded, was originally written on two tablets. On the one he had found, there had been six columns of cuneiform text, but he could piece together only fragments of four columns. It is undoubtedly an Akkadian version of the Sumerian tale of the Tower of Babel, and it is clear from it that the incident was brought about not by mankind, but by the gods themselves. Mankind was only a pawn in the struggle. As pieced together by George Smith and retranslated by W.S.C. Boscawen in the Transactions of the Society of Biblical Archaeology, the tale began with the identification of the instigator. Damage to the lines, however, obliterated the name. The thoughts of this god's heart were evil. Against the father of the gods in Lil, he was wicked. To achieve his evil purpose, the people of Babylon he corrupted to sin, inducing small and great to mingle on the mound. As the sinful work came to the attention of the Lord of the Pure Mound, already identified as Enlil in the cattle and grain tale, Enlil, to heaven and on earth, spoke. He lifted his heart to the Lord of the gods Anu, his father, to receive a command his heart requested. At that time he also lifted up his heart, voice, to Damkina. We well know that she was the mother of Marduk, so all the clues point to him as the instigator. But Damkina stood by his side. With my son I rise, she said. The incomplete verse that follows has her stating that his number, his numerical rank status, was at issue. The legible portion of column 3 then deals with Enlil's efforts to talk the rebellious group out of their plans. Taking himself up in a whirlwind, Nunamnir, Enlil, from the heaven to earth spoke. But by his path they did not go. Violently they fronted against him. When Enlil saw this, to earth he descended. But even his very presence on the site did not make a difference. We found in the last column that when a stop he did not make of the gods, he had no choice but to resort to force. To their stronghold tower, in the night, a complete end he made. In his anger, a command he also poured out. To scatter abroad was his decision. He gave a command their councils to confuse. Their course he stopped. The ancient Mesopotamian scribe ended the tale of the Tower of Babel with a bitter memory. Because they, against the gods, revolted with violence, violently they wept for Babylon. Very much they wept. The biblical version also names Babel, Hebrew for Babylon, as the place where the incident had occurred. The name is significant, for in its original Akkadian, Babili, it meant gateway of the gods, the place by which the gods were to enter and leave Sumer. It was there, the biblical narrative states, that the perpetrators planned to construct a tower, whose head shall reach unto the heavens. The words are identical to the actual name of the ziggurat, seven-stage pyramid, which was the dominant feature of ancient Babylon, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 64. E-sagila, house whose head is lofty. The biblical and the Mesopotamian texts, undoubtedly based on an original Sumerian chronicle, thus relate the same incident. Marduk's frustrated attempt to prevent the transfer of kingship from Kish to Erech and Ur, cities destined to be power centers of Nannar, Sin, and his children, and to seize suzerainty for his own city, Babylon. By this attempt, however, Marduk started a chain of events replete with tragedies. Chapter 10. The Prisoner in the Pyramid. The incident of the Tower of Babel brought to an unexpected end the longest era of peace on earth that man can recall. The chain of tragic events the incident had triggered had, we believe, a direct bearing on the Great Pyramid and its mysteries. To resolve them, we shall offer our own theory of how this unique structure had been planned and constructed, then plugged and broken into. To the many enigmas pertaining to the construction and purpose of the Great Pyramid at Giza, two more were added after its completion. All theories concerning them have been based on the assumption of a royal burial as the pyramid's purpose, have been found flawed and wanting. We believe that the answers lie not in the tales of the pharaohs, but in the tales of the gods. Several references to the Great Pyramid in writings of classical Greek and Roman chroniclers attest to familiarity in their times with the swivel stone entrance into the pyramid, the descending passage, and the subterranean pit. There was no knowledge of the whole upper system of passages, galleries, and chambers, because the ascending passage was plugged tight with three large granite blocks, and further camouflaged with a triangular stone, so that no one going down the descending passage ever suspected that there existed a junction with an upper passage, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 65. Over the many centuries that followed, even the knowledge of the original entrance was forgotten, and when the Caliph Al-Ma'mun decided to enter the pyramid, his men forced an entry by tunneling aimlessly through the masonry. Only when they heard a stone fall somewhere inside the pyramid did they tunnel in the direction of the sound, reaching the descending passage. The stone that had fallen was the triangular stone hiding the junction with the ascending passage. Its fall revealed the granite plug. Unable even to dent the granite blocks, the men cut through the limestone masonry around them, discovering the ascending passage and the upper inner parts of the pyramid. As the Arab historians attest, everywhere Al-Ma'mun and his men found nothing but emptiness. Clearing the ascending passage of debris, pieces of limestone that had somehow slid down the passage to the granite plugs, they crawled up to the upper end of this passage. Coming out of its square-like tunnel, they could stand up, for they had reached the junction of the ascending passage with a horizontal passage and with the grand gallery, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 66. They followed the horizontal passage, reaching the vaulted chamber at its end, which later explorers named the Queen's Chamber. It was bare, and so was its enigmatic niche, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 49. Returning to the junction of the passages, they clambered up the grand gallery, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 45. Its precisely cut grooves, now empty holes and nooks, helped the climb up, a task made slippery by a layer of white dust that covered the gallery's floor and ramps. They climbed over the great step, which rose from the upper end of the gallery to become flush with the floor of the antechamber. Entering it, they found its blocking portcullises gone, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 67. They crawled into the upper vaulted chamber, later named the King's Chamber. It was bare, except for a hollowed-out stone block, nicknamed the Coffer. But it, too, was empty. Returning to the junction of the three passages, ascending passage, grand gallery, and horizontal passage, Al-Ma'mun's men noticed a gaping hole on the western side, where the ramp stone belonging there had been smashed away, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 68. It led via a short horizontal passage to a vertical shaft, which the Arabs assumed was a well. As they clambered down this well shaft, as it came to be called, they found that it was but the upper part of a long, about 200 feet, series of twisting and turning connected shafts that ended with a 6-foot link to the descending passage, and thus provided a connection between the pyramid's upper chambers and passages and its lower ones, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 66. The evidence indicates that the lower opening was blocked up and hidden from whoever had come down the descending passage, until Al-Ma'mun's men lowered themselves through the length of the well shaft and discovered and broke open its bottom end. The Arabs' discoveries and later investigations have raised a host of puzzles. Why, when, and by whom was the ascending passage plugged up? Why, when, and by whom was the twisting well shaft tunneled through the pyramid and its rocky base? The first and most persistent theory fitted the two puzzles into one answer, holding that the pyramid was built by the pharaoh Khufu, Cheops, to be his tomb. The theory suggested that after his mummified body was placed in the coffer in the king's chamber, workmen slid the three granite plug blocks from the grand gallery down the slope of the ascending passage in order to seal off the tomb. This entrapped these workmen alive in the grand gallery. Outwitting the priests, the workmen removed the end stone in the ramp, dug out the well shaft, reached the descending passage, and saved themselves by climbing up it to the pyramid's entrance exit. But this theory does not stand up to critical scrutiny. The well shaft is made up of 7 distinct segments, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 66. It begins with the upper horizontal segment, A, leading from the grand gallery, to a vertical segment, B, which connects via a twisting segment, C, with a lower vertical segment, D. A long, straight, but sharply inclined segment E then follows, leading into a shorter segment F, inclined at a different angle. At the end of F, a segment intended to be horizontal, but in fact slightly slanting, G then connects the well shaft with the descending passage. Apart from the connecting horizontal segments A and G, the well shaft proper, segments B, C, D, E, and F, in spite of its changing of courses when viewed on a north-south plane, lies precisely on an east-west plane parallel to the pyramid's plane of passages and chambers. The separating distance of about 6 feet is bridged at the top by segment A and at the bottom by segment G. While the three upper segments of the well shaft traverse some 60 feet through the pyramid's limestone masonry, the lower segments were cut through some 150 feet of solid rock. The few workmen left behind to slide down the granite plugs could not have been able to cut through the rock. Also, if the digging was from above, where is all the debris, which they could have only brought up as they dug down? With the well shaft's 28-inch bore through most of its segments, the more than 1,000 cubic feet of debris would have piled up in the upper passages and chambers. In view of these improbabilities, new theories were advanced based on an assumption that the well shaft was dug from the bottom up. The debris was then removed via the descending passage to outside the pyramid. But why? The answer is an accident. As the pharaoh was being entombed, an earthquake shook the pyramid, loosening prematurely the granite plugs. As a result, not mere laborers, but members of the royal family and high priests were trapped alive. With the pyramid's plan still available, rescue teams tunneled their way up, reached the grand gallery, and saved the dignitaries. This theory, as well as a long-discarded one about grave robbers digging their way up, falters, among other points, on the matter of precision. With the exception of Segment C, which was tunneled through the masonry in a rough and irregular manner, and Section G, two of whose squarish sides were left rough and not quite horizontal, all the other segments are straight, precise, carefully finished, and uniformly angled throughout their length. Why would rescue workers or grave robbers waste time to achieve perfection and precision? Why would they bother to smooth the sides when such smoothness made climbing the shaft much more difficult? As the evidence mounted that no pharaoh had ever been buried or enshrined within the Great Pyramid, a new theory gained adherence. The well shaft was cut to enable an examination of fissures that had developed in the rock as a result of an earthquake. The most articulate proponents of such a theory were the brothers John and Morton Edgar, who, motivated by a religious zeal, which saw in the pyramid an expression in stone of biblical prophecies, visited, cleared, examined, measured, and photographed every known part of the pyramid. They showed conclusively that the upper short horizontal passage to the well shaft, A, as well as the uppermost vertical section, B, were part and parcel of the original construction of the pyramid, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 69. They also found that the lower vertical section D was carefully built with masonry blocks as it passed through a cavity nicknamed the grotto in the bedrock, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 70. It could have been so constructed only when the rock face was still exposed, before the grotto was covered up with the masonry of the pyramid. In other words, this section too had to be part, a very early part, of the original construction of the pyramid. As the pyramid was rising above its base, so the Edgars theorized, a massive earthquake fissured the bedrock in several places. Needing to know the extent of the damage to determine whether the pyramid could still rise above the cracked bedrock, the builders cut through the rock segments, E and F, as inspection shafts. Finding the damage not too serious, the pyramid's construction continued. But to allow periodic inspection, a short, about 6-foot passage, G, was tunneled from the descending passage to connect with Section F, allowing entry into the inspection shafts from below. Though the theories of the Edgars have been adopted by all such pyramidologists, as well as by some Egyptologists, they still fall short of solving the enigmas. If the long sections, E and F, were emergency inspection shafts, why their precise and time-consuming construction? What was the purpose of the original vertical sections B and D? When and why was the irregular twisting section C forced through the masonry? And what about the granite plugs? Why were they needed if there had been no funeral and no burial? To these questions, there has been no satisfactory answer, neither by pyramidologists nor by Egyptologists. Yet the arduous and zealous measuring and remeasuring by both groups hold the key to the answers. The essential segments of the well shaft, we believe, were indeed executed by the original builders, but neither as an afterthought nor in response to an emergency. They were, rather, the fruit of forethought, features intended to serve as architectural guidelines in the construction of the pyramid. Much has already been written over the centuries of the Great Pyramid's wonderful proportions and remarkable geometric ratios. However, because all other pyramids have only lower inner passages and chambers, the tendency has persisted to view the whole upper system as a later phase development. As a result, little attention was paid to certain alignments between upper and lower features of the pyramid, which can be accounted for only if the upper and lower parts were planned and executed at one and the same time. Thus, for example, the point at the Grand Gallery where the floor rises abruptly to form the Great Step Up, U, the central axis of the Queen's Chamber, Q, and a recess, R, at the lowest short horizontal passage, are all placed exactly on one line, the pyramid's center line. Also, an enigmatic downstep, S, in the upper horizontal passage, is aligned with the point marking the end, P, of the descending passage. And there are more such puzzling alignments, as our next diagram will show. Were all these alignments coincidences, architectural freaks, or the result of careful planning and layout? As we shall now show, these and other hitherto unrecognized alignments flowed from the ingenious, yet simple, planning of the pyramid. And we will also prove that the original segments of the well shaft were integral elements, not only in the execution, but also in the very planning of the pyramid. Let us begin with segment D, because we believe that it was the very first one. It is now generally agreed that the rocky knoll on which the pyramid was erected was flattened out in a stepped manner. The lowest face of the rock, which can be seen outside, formed the baseline. The uppermost face of the rock is at the grotto level. There, the bottom layer, course, of the pyramid's masonry can be seen. Since segment D lies below this masonry, it had to be cut and fashioned through the grotto and the bedrock before anything above it was constructed, i.e., before the well shaft segments A, B, and C, because the only way to tunnel through the rock is from its exposed face downward, segment E, which begins its downward slope precisely from the end of D, could have been cut only after segment D was completed. F had to follow E, and G came last. In other words, D must have been constructed with great precision, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 70. Through the grotto and the rock, before all the other segments of the well shaft. But why was it located where it is? Why is it precisely vertical? Why did it not continue all the way up, but was made of the length of which it is? Why, for that matter, a fact that has gone completely unnoticed, is segment E inclined to D and to the baseline at the precise angle of 45 degrees? And why, if E was meant to serve as a connecting shaft, did it not simply continue until it reached the descending passage, but instead turned at an angle to become segment F? And why is this segment, F, another unnoticed feature, inclined to the ascending passage, at the precise right angle of 90 degrees? To answer these questions, we have asked ourselves, how did the pyramid's architects design and achieve these symmetries, perfect alignments, and remarkable geometric congruations? The solution we have come up with can best be illustrated by a drawing, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 71. It is a layout plan of the pyramid's insides, prepared by us, we believe, as it might have been drawn by the pyramid's own builders. A simple yet ingenious architectural plan that achieves the impressive symmetry, alignments, and perfection with the aid of a few lines and three circles. The construction of the pyramid began with the leveling of the rocky knoll on which it was to rise. To give the structure greater stability, the rock was cut to the base level, only near the pyramid's circumference. At its core, the face of the rock was higher, rising in stages. It was then, we believe, that the grotto, a natural deformity in the rock, or perhaps an artificial cavity, was selected as the point where the structure's alignments were to begin. There, the first of the shafts, D, was placed vertically through the grotto, partly cut through the rock, and partly built with masonry blocks, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 70. Its height, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 71, delineates precisely the distance from the base level to the level where the rock ends and the masonry begins at the pyramid's core. It has been long recognized that the value pi, the factor governing the ratios between a circle or a sphere, its linear elements, and its area projections, has been employed in determining the circumference, sides, and height of the pyramid. As our drawing clearly shows, not only the pyramid's envelope, but also everything inside it, was determined with the aid of three equal circles. Theodolitic equipment, placed within shaft D, beamed upward a key vertical line, whose functions we shall soon describe. But first, this equipment beamed out the horizontal rock masonry line, on which the centers of the three circles were placed. The first of these, point 1, was at D. Points 2 and 3, where its circle intersected the line, served as centers for the other two, overlapping circles. To draw these circles, the pyramid's architects, of course, had to decide on the proper radius. Researchers of the Great Pyramid have been long frustrated by the inability to apply to its perfect proportions any of the ancient Egyptian units of measurement. Neither the common cubit of 24 fingers, nor the royal cubit of 28 fingers, 20.63 inches, or 525 millimeters. Some three centuries ago, Sir Isaac Newton concluded that an enigmatic sacred cubit of some 25.2 inches was used not only in the construction of the pyramid, but also in the construction of Noah's Ark and the temple in Jerusalem. Both Egyptologists and pyramidologists now accept this conclusion as far as the pyramid is concerned. Our own calculations show that the radius adopted for the three circles envisioned by us was equal to 60 such sacred cubits, the number 60 being, not accidentally, the base number of the Sumerian sexagesimal mathematical system. This measure of 60 sacred cubits is dominant in the lengths and heights of the pyramid's inner structure, as well as in the dimensions of its base. Having selected the radius, the three circles were drawn, and now the pyramid began to take shape, where the second circle intersected the base level, point 4. The pyramid's side was to rise at the angle of 52 degrees, a perfect angle, because it is the only one which incorporates the pi ratios into the pyramid. From the bottom of shaft D, shaft E was then tunneled down, precisely inclined at 45 degrees to D. The theodolite beam projected from E upward, intersecting circle 2 at point 5, provided the sloping line of the pyramid's side and also marked off the half-area level on which the king's chamber and the antechamber were to be placed, the 5UK line, and the grand gallery was to end. Projected downwards, the E slope determined point P at which the descending passage was to end, and the vertical line from P determined the downstep S in the upper horizontal passage. Turning to the third circle, we see that its center, point 3, marked the vertical center line of the pyramid. Where it intersected the half-area line, the great upstep, U, was placed, marking the end of the grand gallery and the beginning of the king's chamber floor. It also determined the position of the queen's chamber, Q, which was placed exactly on the center line. By connecting point 2 with point U, the floor line of the ascending passage in the grand gallery was obtained. Shaft F was then tunneled from the end of the shaft E, precisely so that its beam intersected the ascending floor, line 2U, at a right angle, 90 degrees. From its intersection with the first circle, point 6, a line was drawn through point 2, all the way up to the side of the pyramid, point 7. This delineated the descending passage, its junction with the ascending passage, at point 2, and the entrance to the pyramid. The shafts, D, E, and F, and the three circles have thus made possible most of the essential features of the Great Pyramid. Still undetermined, however, were the points at which the ascending passage would end and the grand gallery begin, and accordingly, where the level of the horizontal passage to the Queen's Chamber would be. Here was, we believe, where shaft B came into play. No one has so far pointed out the fact that its length is precisely equal to that of D, and that it marks off exactly the distance between the entrance level and the level of the horizontal passage. B was placed where the ascending line intersected circle 2, point 8. Its vertical extension marks the beginning of the rising wall of the Grand Gallery. The distance from point 8 to point 9, where the beam from D intersects the horizontal line from 8, is the place of the grandiose intersection depicted in figure 68, which can be found in the bonus PDF material. Segment B, connected at point 8 to the passages through the short level segment A, thus enabled the pyramid's builders to complete it inside. When that was done, there was no longer any architectural or functional use for these segments, and the entrance to them was covered by placing there a well-fitting wedge-shaped ramp stone, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 72. Segments D, E, and F have also disappeared from view as the pyramid's masonry rose over the rocky base. It was then, perhaps, the function of the less precisely built segment G to enable the withdrawal of the beaming theodolites from the DEF segments, or to make last-minute checks. Finally, where the descending passage connected with this segment G, the opening was covered with a well-fitting stone block, and these lower segments, too, disappeared from view. The pyramid stood complete, with all the segments of the well shaft in their hidden places, all that is, except one, which, as we have shown, had absolutely no function or purpose in the pyramid's planning and construction. The exception is the irregular and uncharacteristic segment C, unevenly twisting through the masonry, rudely, crudely, and forcibly cut through the limestone courses in a manner that left many stone blocks broken and protruding. When, why, and how did this enigmatic section C come into being? That section, we believe, was not yet in existence when the pyramid was completed by its constructors. It was, we will show, hurriedly forced through later on, when Marduk was imprisoned alive in the Great Pyramid. That Marduk was imprisoned alive in the mountain tomb, there is no doubt. Texts that have been found and authoritatively translated attest to that. Other Mesopotamian texts throw light on the nature of his offense. Altogether, they enable us to arrive at a plausible reconstruction of the events. Evicted from Babylon and Mesopotamia, Marduk returned to Egypt. He promptly established himself in Heliopolis, enhancing its role as his cult center, by assembling his celestial memorabilia in a special shrine, to which Egyptians made pilgrimages for a long time thereafter. But seeking to re-establish his hegemony over Egypt, Marduk found that things had changed since he left Egypt to attempt his coup d'etat in Mesopotamia. Though Thoth, we gather, did not put up a struggle for supremacy, and Nergal and Gibel were far from the center of power, a new rival had emerged in the interim, Dumuzi. That younger son of Enki, his domain bordering Upper Egypt, was emerging as a pretender to the throne of Egypt. And behind his ambitions was none other than his bride, Inanna Ishtar, another cause for Marduk's suspicions and dislike. The tale of Dumuzi and Inanna, he a son of Enki, she a granddaughter of Enlil, reads like an ancient tale of Romeo and Juliet. Like Shakespeare's drama, it too ended in tragedy, death, and revenge. The first presence of Inanna Ishtar in Egypt is mentioned in the Edfu text dealing with the First Pyramid War. Called there Ashtoreth, her Canaanite name, she is said to have appeared on the battlefield among the advancing forces of Horus. The reason for this inexplicable presence in Egypt might have been to visit her bridegroom Dumuzi, through whose district the fighting force was passing. That Inanna had gone to visit Dumuzi, the herder, in his faraway rural district, we know from a Sumerian text. It tells how Dumuzi stood awaiting her arrival and echoes his reassuring words to a bride, baffled by a future in a foreign land. The young lad stood waiting. Dumuzi pushed open the door. Like a moonbeam, she came forth to him. He looked at her, rejoiced in her, took her in his arms and kissed her. The herder put his arm around the maiden. "I have not carried you off into slavery," he said. "Your table will be a splendid table, the splendid table where I myself eat." At that time, Inanna Ishtar had the blessing of her parents, Nannar, Sin, and Ningal, as well as of her brother, Utu, Shamash. To the Romeo and Juliet love match between a granddaughter of Enlil and a son of Enki. Some brothers of Dumuzi and probably Enki himself also gave their consent. They presented Inanna with a gift of lapis lazuli, the blue-hued precious stone she cherished. As a surprise, they hid beads and squares of the stone under a heap of her favorite fruit, dates. In the bedroom she found a bed of gold, adorned with lapis lazuli, which Gibble had refined for her in the abode of Nurgle. And then the fighting broke out, and brother fought brother. As long as the fighting was only between the descendants of Enki, no one saw any particular problem in having a granddaughter of Enlil around. But after the victory of Horus, when Seth occupied lands not his, the situation changed completely. The Second Pyramid War pitched the sons and grandchildren of Enlil against the descendants of Enki. Juliet had to be separated from her Romeo. When the lovers were reunited after that war and their marriage consummated, they spent many days and nights in bliss and ecstasy, the subject of numerous Sumerian love songs. But even as they were making love, Inanna was whispering provoking words to Dumuzi. "As sweet as your mouth are your parts, they befit a princely status. Subdue the rebellious country. Let the nation multiply. I will direct the country rightly." Another time she confessed to him her vision. "I had a vision of a great nation, choosing Dumuzi as god of its country. For I have made Dumuzi's name exalted. I gave him status." With all that, it was not a happy union, for it did not produce an heir, an essential requirement, it appears, for carrying out the divine ambitions. Thus it came to pass that in an attempt to have a male heir, Dumuzi resorted to a tactic adopted way back by his own father. He tried to seduce and have intercourse with his own sister. But whereas in bygone days Ninharsag agreed to Enki's advances, Dumuzi's sister, Geshtinanna, refused. In his desperation, Dumuzi violated a sexual taboo. He raped his own sister. The tragic tale is recorded on a tablet catalogued by scholars as CT 15:28-29. The text relates how Dumuzi bade Inanna goodbye as he announced his plan to go to the desert plain where his flocks were. By prearrangement, his sister, the song-knowing sister, was sitting there. She thought she was invited for a picnic. As they were eating the pure food, dripping with honey and butter, as they were drinking the fragrant divine beer, and were spending the time in a happy mood, Dumuzi took the solemn decision to do it. To prepare his sister for what he had in mind, Dumuzi took a lamb and copulated it with its mother, then had a kid copulate with its sister lamb. As the animals were committing incest, Dumuzi was touching his sister in emulation. But his sister still did not understand. As Dumuzi's actions became more and more obvious, Geshtinanna screamed and screamed in protest. But he mounted her. His seed was flowing into her vulva. "Halt," she shouted. "It is a disgrace." But he did not stop. Having done his deed, the shepherd, being fearless, being shameless, spoke to his sister. What he said is unfortunately lost to us due to breaks in the tablet, but we suspect that he had, fearlessly, shamelessly, as the text had stated, gone on to explain to Geshtinanna the reasons for his deed. That it was premeditated is clear from the text. It is also stated that Inanna was in on the plan. Dumuzi, prior to leaving, spoke to her of planning and advice, and Inanna, to her spouse, answered about the plan. To him, she gave her advice. Rape, under the moral codes of the